If you haven't heard of my next guest, where have you been? Her name is Cindy Blackstock. She's a Gitxaan and the executive director of the First Nations Child and Family Caring Society of Canada. She's also an associate professor at the University of Alberta. According to her Wikipedia entry, yes, she does have one, she's been under surveillance since 2007 by the Department of Aboriginal Affairs. The federal government has spent over $3 million over 5 years fighting a human rights complaint launched jointly by the First Nations Child and Family Caring Society of Canada and the Assembly of First Nations. That case will shortly go forward. I spoke to Cindy from her Ottawa office. Well, you know, I've always thought as a Mohawk guy that you hadn't really arrived yet until the government is spying on you. I don't know if I should start with that, but that's when I first came across your name in the newspaper. I see now you've got it, your own Wikipedia page, but I think that's really when the work that you were doing got national attention. But let's talk a bit about that work that you're doing. You have a human rights complaint, or actually, maybe talk a bit about that, what you're doing now and where that is.
Okay. On February 25th, 2013, history is going to be made in these lands now known as Canada, because for the first time ever, the Canadian government will be appearing before a legal body, in this case the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal, to be held accountable for its current treatment of First Nations children. And the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal is going to decide a complaint that was filed by the Caring Society and AFN in 2007, alleging that the flawed and inequitable funding policies for child welfare amounted to racial discrimination for First Nations kids. And this is a really strong note in history. In the past, we've seen Canada do very harmful things to Aboriginal children, like residential schools, and it's only years later that we're holding commissions to look at what happened. Well, this is an opportunity at this tribunal to have things heard about what's happening right now, and to have the tribunal, if should it find that discrimination is happening, which I'm confident it will, then it has the power to enforce an order on the federal government to make it stop. So this is an important moment in the history of our country, and it's something that I'm really looking forward to in February.
It's a big deal, isn't it?
It is a huge deal. You know what? We don't know of an example anywhere else in the industrialized world where a developed country is being held for account for its treatment of Indigenous children in this way. There's no other examples that we know of anywhere in the Western industrialized world.
Now, in the case which has been heard, the federal government, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong here, but the federal government tried to argue that you can't compare the federal to the provincial. It's apples and oranges. And, you know, these arguments don't apply to us because of jurisdictional issues. That was pretty much their position, right?
Well, the federal government, you're quite right, has spent over $3 million, imagine that, $3 million in legal fees trying to derail a proper hearing on this discrimination complaint. They wanted it thrown out on these legal loopholes, the comparator issue you're talking about, which is even when the same laws apply, it's not fair to compare the federal government, they would say, to the provincial levels of funding. And the other one was, well, we, the federal government, only fund the service and it's social workers who deliver it. So if First Nations families on reserve are feeling they get a lesser quality of service, they should hold the social worker accountable and not us. Well, that's ridiculous, because it's not the social worker who can make the services equitable, it's the federal government. And I'm so grateful, even though it's taken 5 years to finally get rid of these legal technicalities, that the path is now cleared for this full and proper hearing. And the Canadian government lost on that, and I'm confident that they're going to lose on the discrimination complaint as well. And when they do, not only do First Nations kids win, but I would argue every person who lives in Canada wins, because racial discrimination against kids is not good for anybody.
So what will this mean, that the claim prevails, the human rights claim prevails, and the federal government is defeated? What does this mean for our children, for the communities?
Well, what we've asked for, and it's important for community members to know, there's not a dime in there for the Caring Society or for the Assembly of First Nations. We would like our legal fees paid back, if that's possible, but if we don't, our priority is that these funds get out there to families to keep kids safely in their family homes. And for those children who do have to be removed, that there's better supports in place for them, and that we're really working in more focused ways with families so that children can be reunited sooner. And we know where to start, because the Canadian Incident Study has said, as many community members have, that the key issues driving First Nations kids into child welfare care are poverty, poor housing, and caregiver substance misuse that can be linked back to residential schools. Those are things with equitable funding that's structured in flexible ways that we actually can help families with. And that's what I'm looking forward to at the end of the tribunal, and with the order that the tribunal will make towards equity. Now, I think we should all be watchful, mindful, that the federal government, if it loses, may well appeal. And I think that's where we as citizens need to be an active part of the case. And in fact, we have a whole public engagement campaign and education campaign about this historic case on a website called fnwitness.ca. And what we do is we load up all the court documents for both sides and all the reports and have people read them themselves and make up their own mind about whether Canada is treating First Nations kids fairly. And right now, there's close to 11,000 people and organizations from all over the world following the case. It's the most watched human rights case in Canadian history.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that website. Maybe we should also mention your organization has a website people can visit.
Right. And the website is called We're with the First Nations Child and Family Caring Society. So it's F as in First, N as in Nations, caringsociety.com. And right on the homepage, you're going to find 7 free ways that any individual of any age or organizations or First Nations governments or communities can all get engaged in helping ensure that all First Nations children have culturally based equity, not only in child welfare, but in education and health services as well.
I've been following this for quite some time. I wrote a book, just finished it actually, delivered it to the publisher. It's about the residential schools, but I finish with the 60s scoop with adoption and look backward to Section 88 of the Indian Act and when the provinces started to intervene, shall I say, in First Nations communities. When I was going through your testimony to one of the Senate committees, you said that there are more children, more First Nations children in the care of the state now than there were under residential schools? Could that be the case?
It is the case. Just to give you an example, we know from the great work of the Royal Commission on Aboriginal Peoples and John Molloy, the historian in particular, that in the late 1940s, when residential schools were at their height of operations, there were approximately 8,200 First Nations children in those schools. If we took the number of First Nations children just in care in BC and Alberta alone, there's well over 11,000 children in those two provinces in foster care. That's two provinces. We don't have, unfortunately, across this country, a central data collection mechanism on child welfare, which is something that needs to change. It's been done in the United States, so it's certainly possible here, but we don't have it. But our best estimate is that there are about 3 times the number of First Nations children in child welfare care today than there were at the height of residential schools operations.
Wow, that's a really discouraging thought.
It is. And the only positive news is we have First Nations agencies, which early indications are that are doing a much better job at keeping kids within their communities. But what we want to do is keep kids in their families safely. And that's where this additional funding really needs to go.
Well, when you read about education or children's welfare services and so on, I think it's usually portrayed as this is just about money, getting more money. But really, it's a lot more than that, isn't it? And then there are underlying structural problems as well.
Right. And, you know, I know the minister and others in the government will say, well, why do we want to throw more money at First Nations child welfare? Well, the reason for that is because you're funding it at a lesser level than all other Canadians receive. And throwing money at inequality actually works. And spending money on children as a government particularly works. Whatever the World Health Organization says, for every dollar you spend on a child as a government, you save $7 down the line. I can't think of one of these economic stimulus projects that the government has undertaken the last number of years that had a 700% return rate. But had they invested in First Nations children and other children in the country, they would be seeing those 700% return rates.
Wow. Yeah, it's short-sighted, I guess. But
well, it's short-sighted, and, you know, there's also, you know, we hear a lot of rhetoric right now going around about, well, we can't afford equity in education or in child welfare. Well, what they're really saying is that they're embracing racial discrimination against children as a legitimate fiscal restraint measure. Is that really what Canada stands for? Is that really where we're at? I mean, this case, this child welfare case, is about child welfare, of course, and about First Nations children and families. But it's also about, strikes a chord as to what actually is the type of country that Canada wants to be. Because if it doesn't want to be a country that racially discriminates against little kids, then it needs to stop doing it.
So this could be, go on for some time then, if there are more appeals and so on. Do you have a sense of when this may be resolved?
Well, the hearings are scheduled through to August of 2013. And then the decision, I hope, the guidelines of the tribunal say they normally rule within 4 to 6 months after that. I think when that ruling comes down, we need to embrace our role as citizens to hold the government accountable. If they've been found by an independent tribunal to be racially discriminating against little kids, then it's my hope and expectation that every Canadian across this country says, you must change this. We don't care what the courts say or don't say. This is unacceptable. It is un-Canadian. And you got to step up to the plate and do the right thing. And I think that's where the growing number of particularly non-Aboriginal peoples who have come to understand these inequities and feel they're unacceptable and are really taking important actions to end it, by growing that number out so that more people know about it, I think that's really the best chance for First Nations children.
So if I can, I know you're the face of this in a lot of respects, and I am intrigued, though, by, you know, your background. I don't really know much about who you are or how you came to be doing this work. Can you talk a little bit about that sort of stuff?
Well, I grew up I was born in 1964 in northern BC.
Oh, we're the same age.
Really? Oh, we're here at the Dragons. This is our year, you know, Wayne. This is where we should be buying all the lottery tickets and doing all the wishes. Certainly, I throw in a lot of pennies into the wishing well for the kids for their equity this year. At any rate, I grew up at that time, and I don't know if it was different for you, but there was lots of signs of racism. It was very flagrant in those days. I've said publicly there were two things you didn't want to be. I remember thinking this even as a 5- and 6-year-old girl. One was a communist, and I wasn't too sure what they were like, although I saw them on TV. And we were just getting color TV, so we got to see them in their green uniforms and the rest of it. And they had some kind of accent, but that's as much as I could understand. And then the second thing was being an Indian. And that idea of being an Indian not being a good thing was mapped all over society, even into the games that children would play around cowboy and Indian. No one wanted to be the Indian because you'd be the first one killed off in the game. And the Indians were always the one doing bad things to the cowboys in white hats. And then in elementary school, I was fortunate enough not to go to residential schools. I was in public school. But I was often the only Aboriginal girl in my class. And I'd be looking around, and there'd be no other Aboriginal kids. And it didn't really occur to me where they were. Because even in our own community, people weren't talking about residential schools. There was so much shame and hurt around it. It was really a silence. Mm-hmm. And when we used to go to Burns Lake or other small towns in northern BC to do grocery shopping, because we really lived out in the bush in most cases, I would see First Nations persons with substance misuse issues. And even in the community where I'm coming from, the substance misuse issues, some of my earliest memories are around that. So all of that added up to be signs that being a First Nations person was not what you wanted to be. And it was easy for people to think, well, you know, it's because they choose this for themselves that they're not able to do it. And some of those messages even made it over to me. Like, I mean, Aboriginal people never went on to high school. I don't remember knowing one Aboriginal person when I was younger who had been to a university. The only people that told me about university were non-Aboriginal people. And so as I grew up, I started to understand that it wasn't because Aboriginal people had chosen this. It's because they were placed in a set of circumstances. We were placed in a set of circumstances where really it's a miracle that we're even around anymore, and a credit to that resilience. And so that sense of injustice really infused me. And I ended up in child welfare working at a group home when I was a teenager, earning enough money to go to university. Because of that whole thing around getting free post-secondary education turns out not to be so true for many of us. So I was working three jobs, one of which was the group home. And I saw the kids come in there, and I thought, you know, we're removing them and replacing them here in a group home. And I remember these two First Nations girls in particular who had come from a First Nations community in northern BC that was quite remote. And they didn't even know how a shower worked or any of these other things. They knew a lot about how to survive on the land and all those rich skills. But this was a new environment and a very traumatizing environment for them to be in. And I had to ask myself, is being away from their family and everything that they know to be normal, is that really in their best interest? So as I did child protection for 10 years, I started to see that many of the families are risk factors that put not only First Nations, because I worked on a reserve, the Squamish Nation, but I also worked off reserve in child welfare. The factors that put most families at risk are things that they could not control. It was things like poverty and poor housing and substance misuse. And I thought, you know, there's lots of people trying to protect children from their families, but there's not a lot of people out there trying to protect families from wayward public policy. And that's what I decided to take up. And I was honored to work with First Nations child welfare agencies in BC and develop an organization there and then extend those relationships across the country. And what I always saw were First Nations folks who were absolutely committed to doing the right thing for kids, who knew that we could be doing a lot better for the kids, even servicing from First Nations agencies, but needed that equitable opportunity to respond to their kids' needs. And so that's how I ended up where I am at.
Wow. That's, yeah. And it's going to be taking up a lot of your time for the foreseeable future, it sounds like.
Yes, it will. And you know what? We really welcome people to show up at the hearings in person to listen to them, because really it's going to be historic. I don't know, perhaps you do, Wayne, I don't know of another situation where government officials will be testifying under oath about their treatment of First Nations peoples in this way.
Yeah. Well, actually, it's interesting you mention that, because I had some conversations with George Erasmus. You mentioned RCAP, and that
right.
was a public inquiry, and they had the power to do that sort of approach with subpoenas and so on, the full powers of the inquiry. They did decide not to do that, so I don't know of any other example, but I've often wondered what would have happened
right.
if they'd actually taken that step. I've heard the reasons why they didn't, but I think you're right. This is unprecedented.
Yeah, and then the other thing, too, is I'll also be testifying under oath, but I think all of us as First Nations will, holding ourselves equally accountable to that standard. But I think what it really signals is how rare it is that the government is in a situation where it has to tell the truth and where it can't hide behind spin and other mechanisms that it normally hides behind in order to perpetrate these types of policies.
Now, where will these hearings take place?
They will be taking place at the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal, which is located on Elgin Street in Ottawa. But one of the things I'm so thankful for is Aboriginal People's Television Network has been successful in its federal court application to televise the tribunal hearings.
Okay.
Canada was opposed to that broadcasting. We, of course, are very supportive of that broadcasting. We feel that First Nations citizens, no matter where they live, have a right to watch this case and be involved in it. APTN had to take it all the way to the federal court, and the federal court agreed that the interests of First Nations peoples to watch it overrode the government's concern that its bureaucrats would be testifying, and then what they might say might damage their relationships with First Nations.
Mm-hmm. Now, if somebody wanted to do this, how would they go about testifying to the committee?
You can't testify. It's actually a court hearing. So, but what you can do is come and watch the proceedings.
Come and watch. Good.
Yes.
Well, I will put that out there then. And it's a short trip here from where I am in Toronto. So I would like to be there myself.
And that would be wonderful. And all of the dates are listed on the fnwitness.ca website so that people are aware when they are there. And the place is accessible for persons with disabilities or young mums or dads with strollers.
Perfect. Before we close up, I'll leave the last word with you. Is there any message you'd like to get out there to folks that we haven't touched upon?
Well, I think it's really important to know that every person listening to this program is at a point in history where we have a chance of addressing this long-standing inequality that First Nations children are living in their hearts every day. And it's an undertow to their dreams and hopes. And they have and every person listening has an opportunity to do something that will make a difference in under 2 minutes. So go onto the website fncaringsociety.com and find out about these 7 things to make a difference and do something, because caring is not enough. Being a bystander doesn't help at this moment.
We need people to get involved, to educate themselves, and to educate, to spread the word to their families, communities, and to other folks in the country. This really is the moment that we have all been waiting for.
Cindy Blackstock, thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Wayne.